All right, so we're continuing our study for the summer. You all have your packets, I hope. That's okay, you don't. Did anybody not get the packet? I mean, I know you may not have it with you, but if you didn't get packets, we can print more. I know that some people may not have gotten them, so we want to make sure you get them if you didn't. So I will print some more off after the lesson tonight and make sure that you get packets. This is a 12 part study of God. We're studying Him. And over the course of the studies that we've been doing for the past several weeks, we started off with just an introduction, but then lesson two was the transcendent God. That was understanding that God is above all things. And then lesson three was the infinite God. That understanding that God didn't have a beginning, He didn't have an ending, He has always been there. Lesson four was about the Trinity, reminding us that God has three different beings, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and what that looks like and what that means to us. Lesson five was the unchanging God, that we can be assured that God does not change. What God said has not changed, and what God wants for us and from us has not changed. So starting tonight, we're on lesson six, which is the only, or God only wise. So the idea being here that having power, even absolute power, is not necessarily a virtue if you don't know how to use it wisely. So wisdom is the ability to choose the best possible end, and then to choose the best possible means of achieving that end, all right? And that is the ability to make the right decisions when judging between two different courses of action. So putting all this knowledge that you may have into action is wisdom. But the author here does, if you we'll drop down in just a minute, but he makes a point that being ultimately wise is not necessarily the end all be all if you can't do anything with that wisdom. And being ultimately powerful is just scary if you don't have the wisdom to use it. So the Bible teaches that God is all wise. He is the only wise God. We can read about that in Romans chapter 16 and verse 27. Wisdom and power belong to Him. And in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 20, it says, "Oh, the depth and the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are His judgments and unfathomable His ways." That's Romans chapter 11, verse 33, sorry. "He is mighty in strength and understanding." These are all verses that we have heard of and we know. "God's wisdom is manifested in His work of creation. O Lord, how many are Your works in wisdom? You have made them all." We can read about that in Psalms 104, verse 24. "And the Lord, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, He established the heavens. It is He who made the earth by His power, who established the world by His wisdom." God's wisdom is seen also in His works of providence, especially in His ability to use the forces of nature and the free decisions of human beings to carry out His purposes. And we talked about that a little this morning, how God used Abraham because Abraham was the man that God needed at the time. He was able to promise something to Abraham and then use Abraham in his faith and the faith that he had towards God to bring to fruition the purposes that he desired. And that was Christ. Through Abraham and through his seed, the promise that God gave Abraham, A great number of people, many, many nations, would be blessed through him, but also that his descendants would be innumerable as the stars, they have said. And yes, the nation of Israel came through Abraham, but more importantly, Christ came through Abraham. The idea that God had put those things into motion using his wisdom. This enables him to bring good results out of bad circumstances. And to make us this promise, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. So with this, we have complete confidence that God can do what he promised, that he will do what he said he will do. That indicates that God is not frustrated or thwarted by any contingency. I think my favorite idea there is the fact that every time we have the Lord's Supper, I think of Satan and the Jews and the Romans just cringing their hands, so happy that they killed Jesus, not knowing that they were fulfilling exactly what God wanted, to give us freedom from sin. That without those people having done that, we would be in a very different position right now. But that Satan and all those evil people who killed Jesus did it because God wanted that to happen. That was his plan. That is wisdom. God is not frustrated or thwarted by any contingency, either from sin-corrupted nature or from evil hearts and hands of men. Even pain and suffering may be harnessed for good results by the all-wise ruler. That's important for us to remember when we're going through trials and tribulations, that we can trust that God can cause all things to work for good. No matter what we're going through, no matter how bad it may seem, there is, as they say, a silver lining in the cloud storm. There is something to look forward to. God's wisdom is supremely made known in his works of redemption in Jesus Christ. His cross is the power of God and the wisdom of God. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 24. The gospel proclaimed by the church demonstrates the manifold wisdoms of God. That is that God is able to take all of these different ideas, all of these prophecies that were given about Jesus, all of these different things that were said, and to make them happen, to make them come true. How Jesus was able to fulfill hundreds of prophecies in 3 years of ministry is amazing to me, but he did it. And he said he did it, and God doesn't lie. So we know that that did happen. If we truly believe God is wise, we will trust his purposes in creation. And we will believe that a world with free will creatures is the best possible world, even though such creatures have the ability to sin. If we believe that God is wise, we will not attempt to criticize or judge what he brings to pass or allows to happen, especially in view of Romans chapter 28, that God can cause good to come from all things. And only someone who is wiser than God has the right to sit in judgment upon his providence. That's important. We need to remember that God's wisdom supersedes anybody else's. Who are we to question what God has put into motion? We don't know his purpose, and he is far wiser than we are. Carol.
I think of lots of people in the Bible and people that I know, but you think of Rahab the harlot, and you think of Samson and how bad Samson was, and yet God still uses a person who's in the right place at the right time to accomplish whatever he wants to accomplish. So you may not feel like you should be doing that, but if you get the feeling that God says you're supposed to do it, even if you're not feeling like you're worthy enough, you should think about doing it.
Right. And I think to that point, there's so many even worse things. Habakkuk, when he talks to God about the evil that God is allowing to happen, and God says, well, just wait, buddy, because I got the Assyrians coming for you. And Habakkuk says, oh, hold on. We don't need to go that far. Well, God's wisdom ruled in that situation. God knew exactly what the people needed. And it may come through bloodshed and it may come through hardship. That may be the case. But God will cause it all to work out again. And if God were merely omnipotent, we would have more reason to be afraid of him than to put our confidence in him. And we need to remember that he is both powerful and wise. Because somebody who is all powerful but does not have the wisdom to use that is just scary. That's a scary idea. And like I said before, somebody who is wisdom without power would be pathetic. A broken weed and power without wisdom would be merely frail. But when you have both of those things in God, then you can trust in what he says. And when he says that he will bring something to pass, you can believe that that'll happen. You don't have to guess about it. You don't have to worry as to whether or not it's going to happen. And like Abraham, when you're waiting a long time for it, you don't have to try and help him. He doesn't need your help. He will make it happen on his time. So that's the foundation of what we're studying tonight. So the first question that pops up, let's see if that. And we've defined wisdom now, the manifestations of God's wisdom, the consequence of transcendent power without wisdom, and what Romans 28 tells us about the nature of the good that is promised to us. So how is wisdom defined in this lesson that we just looked at? When you're going to try and tell somebody what wisdom is, what is wisdom?
It,
Yeah.
the proper application of the proper application of knowledge.
Okay. So taking the things that you know and applying it properly, wisely. And we try and shy away from using the word to define the word, but using it in an appropriate manner, in the best way possible, in a way that's going to bring the best outcome for all who are involved. And that's not always possible for us, is it? We may have some wisdom, but is it possible for us to anticipate all outcomes of the actions we take? It is not built.
Proverbs repeatedly tells us to get wisdom.
Yep.
That wisdom is the greatest thing we can have. It's better than silver and gold. And knowing how to use it in any situation would just about make you a perfect person. Because you'd never make a mistake.
Right. Well, you would think that, but God granted wisdom in larger quantities to one person more than anybody else on this planet. Right? And so he never made mistakes, right? Yeah, Solomon, he was a very wise person, and people came from around the world to see his wisdom implemented. But did he make mistakes? He did make mistakes. Just because you have some wisdom and the ability to apply that wisdom correctly sometimes does not mean that you are omnipotent or all wise. Carol.
I got to thinking about this consequence of transcendent power without wisdom. I got to thinking of Midas and the Midas touch. He thought of what he wanted, but he didn't realize he'd never be able to touch anybody again. I mean, he would lose so much. So what we see in life is this much, but we can't see the ripples
right.
that affect us.
The bigger picture.
Right, and that's the point, is can you imagine setting into motion the plan of salvation from the creation of the world? And the thousands and thousands of years and the choices that would be made by so many different people. And God used it all and accomplished his task exactly how he wanted to. That's wisdom. That's the ability to use unending knowledge and unending power, in his case, to bring forth good. That was his goal, his accomplishment. So, what are three ways that God's wisdom is manifested? And it refers us to our lesson. So, three ways that God manifests his wisdom in the lives of people today.
Well, I wrote down three things. I'm not sure if they're right.
Okay.
I wrote down in his work of creation.
Sure.
In his work of providence and the work of redemption.
Absolutely. I would not argue with you there one bit. We look at creation, and that's one of the things we talk about here. We look at creation, and we see that God made man with the ability to choose. Was that wise? Is that going to lead to his purposes being fulfilled?
Yes.
Well,
in some cases.
Now, if it was God's goal to have 100% of every person who's ever born make it into his kingdom, then we might double guess about God's wisdom. But that's not God's goal, is it? God's goal is to offer that to everybody, but for them to make the choice to do it. God doesn't want you there if you don't want to be there. If you're not going to make the choice to make God your God, then that's God inviting Satan into his kingdom. He doesn't need that. He wants people who want to be there. So God gives you the free will choice to choose whether or not you want to be part of his kingdom. And there's nothing wiser than that. Because God is giving us the option to choose whether or not we want to be part of him. Now, I think about it like this. God gave you life, and God's going to take it away. You're not going to live forever. And when he does take that life away, you're going to have to explain to God the choices you made. And there's so many people who don't believe that, that believe that once you're dead like Rover, you're dead all over, and that when life ends, it just ends. Aren't they going to be shocked when they're standing face to face with their God and explaining the life they lived? Which is scary, I agree. That's a scary thing to think about, even for those of us who have chosen to be saved. Because responding to God about the things we did in our past life, or the sins we've committed since we became part of his kingdom, that's scary for me. So I've made choices that I shouldn't have made as a Christian. We all have, right? But we still have to explain that to God. But imagine the person who does not have the redemptive blood of Christ explaining their life to God, because they made the choice not to do that. I'm not going to go to that hypothetical where there's somebody out there who's never heard of Jesus. But I fully believe that God gives the avenue for each and every person who's born to be exposed to his message. Whether or not you choose to react to that, respond to it, pursue it, that's your choice. But I think that God gives the opportunity to everybody. And if there are people that don't get exposed, that aren't given the message, then God will judge them based on his wisdom. But I fully believe that everybody gets the option. Everybody gets the opportunity, and that a lot of people choose not to join. Jimmy.
I'm just thinking, we still sin, even if we are Christians and stumble. But the good part about that, Jesus and God will forgive us. We have the option to repent and go on, don't do that anymore. So
right.
If we will still end up in heaven if we obey his will.
But again, God doesn't force anything on you.
Oh, no.
No? So you can choose to sin it even as a Christian. And you can choose not to ask for forgiveness. But a person in that situation knows what the outcome is. So,
yeah,
so it's important for us to always remember to pray. To always pray. To pray as often as you can. Pray for yourself. Pray for your family. Pray for your friends. But pray for forgiveness. Because we do things all day long that from our point of view may not seem wrong, but from somebody else's point of view may seem terribly wrong. So it's important to just always pray. To have that. There's always an open line of communication between God to you. Mine's, I always carry it on me, I have that problem. So I have it with me whenever somebody asks me a question and I can't pull it out of my brain. That line is always open. The question is, are you responding to God's communication to you by praying? I don't pray enough, I can tell you that. I wish I prayed a whole lot more than I do. But we all need to pray as much as we can, as often as we can. And ask for forgiveness on a regular basis, because there may be sins we're committing that we don't even know we're committing. So, what would be the consequence of having a transcendently powerful being who is not also transcendently wise? So, somebody who is omnipotent, has the power to do anything that they want at any time, but does not have the wisdom to use that power.
Chaos for those people around them.
Yeah. When I looked at that question, I remembered a movie. And I can't remember the name of the movie. Somebody here will probably remember it. It had the... I'll try to remember it. But it's the gist of the movie is this man is given the power of God. And he finds out what that responsibility is really like. What it's like to be God. And he learns that that's not something that he wants. He doesn't want that responsibility because he doesn't have the wisdom to use that power. And if you don't have the wisdom to use omnipotent power, then you shouldn't have it. That would be a scary thing though, wouldn't it? Somebody who's all powerful, but not wise enough to use that wisely, not wise enough to use that for good, I guess, so that all things come for good or to good. What promises made for us in Romans 8 and 28? And that's the Romans 8 and 28 is the verse that reads, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." So what promise is made for us in Romans 8 and 28? And what does the context of this verse suggest about the nature of the good promise to us? So let's answer that first question. What promise is made for us in that verse?
If we love God in our hearts with God, that everything, that even bad things that happen to us are going to work out for good eventually.
Yep. And as we said this morning, that may require patience. It may require us to wait. And it may require us to wait a long time. In fact, it may require us to wait until we die. It may not happen in our lifetimes. Did Abraham see the promise fulfilled in his lifetime? No. I talked about that this morning. He had one son, two grandsons. That's all he saw. Isaac, Jacob, and Esau. He lived long enough to see Jacob and Esau born. He lived 15 years after that. That's all he saw. Is that a nation of stars that are not countable? He didn't see that in his lifetime. Did he believe it? I think that he did. I think he believed that God would keep his promise. Did that come to pass? It most certainly did. That the nation of Israel grew to numbers that were immense. But more importantly, Christ came through that lineage. And it's because of his lineage that he is saved. His faith, his endurance. He wavered just like we all do. But it's because he stuck to it that he was able to see the start of that promise being fulfilled.
Ted?
Yeah.
And the good that comes from something may not actually be a good that comes necessarily to you. It might be to somebody else who's seeing what's happening. And then, of course, the latest example of that is Carolyn, because she impressed so many people with what she was going through, and you could really just see God acting in her life and providentially putting her here and doing this and doing that. You could just see it. And, you know, I don't know that she saw that, but she will know that now. But it, the good doesn't necessarily come to you, but it will work for good.
Yeah, it doesn't tell us that God will cause it for good for you. It says God will cause it for good. Bill.
A long time ago, when I was a teenager, I took a long bicycle ride. And I was going home, and it was late in the day, and I got a flat tire. And I stopped and asked some people if I could use their phone so I could call my folks. These folks gave me a ride home. And I said, how do I thank you? And they said, just do something for somebody else.
Yeah,
and I've never forgotten that. That was a long time.
Right.
Pay it forward.
Yep. I get you. So the next idea here is in the lesson is God's dealings with his people. So we look at Jacob. And the question is, how did Jacob describe the days of his life with Pharaoh in Genesis chapter 47 and verse 9? And that reads, Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my journey through the life are 130. My years have been few and hard. They aren't as many as the years of my fathers before me. So how did Jacob describe the days of his life with Pharaoh? When we think of Jacob, what do we think of?
That he's blessed.
Blessed. He was the salvation of his family, right?
Yeah.
Without him, his family probably would have died from the famine, right? We see all the blessings that Jacob brought to his family. How does Jacob look at it?
The days have been few and evil.
Few and hard. Yeah, this has been a really tough life for me, right? That's his point of view. What's his brother's point of view? His brother's saying, you saved our lives. You saved the life of my wife, my kids, all of us. You saved our father. Right? Can you think of some of the painful things that happened in Jacob's life? I mean, what did he go through? Just the time, in the time that he was in Egypt, you can think of a whole bunch of things that he went through. You know, he was jailed for something he didn't do. The Potiphar's wife accused him of rape. He didn't do that. Yeah.
That's Joseph, not Jacob.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. You're right. You're right. You're right. And
start with a J.
Yeah. You're right. I got lost. Yeah.
Well, Jacob had the wife swap.
Right.
And then he had all this discourse in the family, and then he thought that Joseph was dead. I mean,
right. I mean, think of what Jacob went through with just that. So he got tricked into marrying Leah, but he wanted to marry Rachel. What does that mean he had to do? It's 4 or 7 years. Okay. But what choice did he have to make to get Rachel?
He had to work another 7 years for her.
What is God's rule about marriage? What choice did he have to make to marry Rachel? Right.
He was already married.
He was already married, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Did he have to commit adultery to marry the sister?
No.
Really? Was he married?
He was married.
Right? He had to, in order to start that second relationship, did he have to commit sin? And think about it hard. One man, one woman. He had two wives, actually four wives. Did he commit sin to marry Rachel? Now we just talked about God doesn't change. What did God say about marriage? One man and one woman. What did Jacob do? He married more than one woman. Now we look at that and say, well, that was culture. Was it right in God's eyes? But what did God do with that relationship? What did he use it for? There may have been sin committed there, but he married two women and married two more after that, because he had there the 12 sons of Israel were descended from four different women. So we think about that. And if we, after a study that God doesn't change, we understand that Jacob made a choice. It was a choice to sin. But did he live in sin? I don't think so. I don't think that God thought that. He had multiple wives. And it was through Jacob's choice that God brought it for good. He may have sinned when he made that choice. And he was tricked into it. I don't begrudge that. He had one woman that he wanted to marry. His intentions were good. But that's not the way it worked out. Yeah.
Isn't there a verse, I can't remember where or anything is, that says that he suffered that to happen. So it's like he put up with it even though it wasn't.
It wasn't his first choice, was it? It wasn't what he wanted.
That's not what God wanted either, but at the same time, he knew it was going to happen.
Right. it was a sin committed, right? But God used it for good. And God does that a lot. What do we know about? We just talked about the harlot.
Rahab,
right. So we look at Rahab. Was she living a life of sin?
Yes.
Okay. Right? Yes. But did God use her for good?
Yes.
Absolutely. Is Jesus descended through her lineage?
Yes.
Yes. God used her for good. God uses sin for good. Right? He doesn't choose it. He doesn't condone it. But when it happens, he can make it work for good. Yeah, Vicki.
I'm kind of stuck on what you said about Jacob sinning to get Rachel,
okay,
but not continuing to live in sin.
Okay.
That doesn't make sense to me. To commit sin to get something, if you don't quit that sin, then you're continuing it.
Well, what is God's rule about marriage?
One man, one woman.
From the beginning, is from what Jesus said.
God said, one man, one woman, right?
Right.
How many wives did he have?
More than one.
More than one.
So maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you had said that he sinned to get Rachel, but did not continue to live in the
If family. You're married and you have sex with another woman, are you not committing adultery? But, okay, he married that woman, right? Okay, so this we have to have the discussion about, you know, I think the biggest topic we fall on here is when does sin stop when we talk about marriage and this kind of adultery that occurred? Well, if he married her, is marriage sinful?
Marriage to one woman is not. Unless she dies, and then he can get remarried.
Okay.
But he made a covenant with two women.
Yeah.
And then
did he break the covenant with either woman?
No. Yes. Maybe.
That wasn't God's choice. That was Jacob's choice. I'm just telling you the facts. The fact is, if you're married to somebody and you have sex with somebody else, you've committed adultery, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But if you're married to both of them, and
right.
Then does that stop it?
If it's marriage, you may have started the relationship in sin, but
once he gets, well,
I don't think God will.
That's how they got married there too, is by sleeping.
Well, did God acknowledge Jacob's second marriage?
He blessed him.
He blessed both women. We read that in Ruth.
He did.
Both women were blessed. I'm not trying to go down the anthill of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I was just pointing out the facts that Jacob said he lived a hard life and he lived a life of sin.
I can't get my app to work on my phone, so yeah. I can't find the verse, but if you go into the giving of the law,
right?
So it says that man shall have one wife.
Right.
But what's it following up with? If he gives, so the entire law is, this is the law, don't break it. But if you break it, this is how you fix it.
Right.
So we're told by God in Leviticus to have one wife. But if you get a second wife, then all you've done as a man is double your responsibility.
Exactly.
He doesn't tell you to get rid of one of the wives.
No.
So we forget about that verse so many times when we talk about this, because we're in today's culture.
Right.
And think of the Mormons, and we think of polygamy, and we think of all those things. But marriage was a covenant relationship that really...
Marriage is a covenant relationship.
Is a covenant relationship that was designed to protect the woman.
Right.
So the man takes on a dual responsibility. He doesn't give half to one woman and half to another woman. He gives his all to both.
Right.
So we need to remember that, because like Vicky's like, oh no, you know, marriage, divorce, remarriage, that's what's in her mind right now.
Right.
But God covers it.
Right.
And all of the debate on marriage, divorce, remarriage, nobody ever wants to go back to that verse where God said, here's the result.
Right.
You have two, take care of two.
Right.
You have 22, you're a fool. But
well, and he wound up with four, so he wound up having to take care of four. But, you know, again, God used that relationship and those children to build his kingdom.
Solomon was in trouble then, wasn't he?
I don't know what the difference between a wife and a concubine is, so I can't really tell you, but he had more than enough, I can tell you that. But anyway, when we're dealing with, God's dealing with his people here, what were some of Jacob's character flaws? I think we've talked about some of those character flaws. And how did these painful things serve to correct some of these flaws? The things that he had to go through. How did they correct those flaws that Jacob had?
Well, he had a problem from the beginning when he got the blessings from his father and from his brother of lying. And they came to fruition in his own life. They came back to bite.
Yeah. His life started hard, even coming out of the womb. Of course, it is what it is. He suffered. He did. He really did suffer. And he paid the price. It was difficult.
And yet he could still see God in his life, especially when the dealings with his greedy father-in-law, God blessed him with all of the herds that he did, and that shows you that he knew that God was still with him. He was still doing what God told him to do with the best of his ability.
Right. And even with the sin that his father-in-law committed against him, God brought it forgiven. Right? So God is able to use his wisdom to bring our intentional wrongdoings for good for others.
And even though he was tricked and abused, basically, anybody would say that he was really tricked, he still worked and gave his everything for those 7 more years.
Yeah. I mean, I think of Abraham too. Abraham, he got impatient.
Yeah.
And took his wife's concubine that was given to him. Again, was that legal? I don't see where it's okay for you to have another woman when you're married. And through that woman came Ishmael, right? But again, God brought it for good. Abraham told that he would be blessed with a nation of multitude of the stars. And so it's not just the Israelites, but everybody who's descended through Ishmael as well, right? So if we look at Genesis 32 and 25, that's what this refers to for the painful things that he went through. I was going to look at that real quick, 32 and 25. It says, the man saw that he couldn't win, so he touched the inside of Jacob's hip. As Jacob struggled with the man, Jacob's hip was twisted. This was when Jacob was wrestling the angel, right?
Yeah.
And from that point on, Jacob had a limp. All right? So he went through some tough stuff. Physically tough stuff. Stuff that would, put people on chronic narcotic therapy. But he endured, and the next question is about Joseph. What are some of the bad things that happened to Joseph in his life? How did Joseph look back on these things in hindsight? So we can start with some of the bad things that happened to Joseph before he was in Egypt.
Brothers wanted to get rid of him.
No, his brothers did get rid of him. Yeah, they wanted to kill him, but you'd have talked them out of doing that. They just got rid of him.
Well,
and then
didn't do anything, but his brothers hated him because the father loved him more.
Right.
So that started everything.
Yeah. So because of his father's superior love for him over his other children.
But he was the baby.
Yeah.
God loved the baby.
Well, and God had him prophesy, and they all got a little offended at what he prophesied from God. You know, that they were going to bow down, even his father, so.
But what does Joseph say about what he went through? So in Genesis chapter 45, verses 7 and 8, he says, but God sent me ahead of you to keep some of you alive on earth. He sent me here to save your lives by an act of mighty power. So that it wasn't you who sent me here, it was God. He made me like a father to Pharaoh, He made me a master of Pharaoh's whole house. He made me a ruler over the whole land of Egypt. How does Joseph look at the evil that happened to him?
That's for good.
God caused it for good. Yeah.
Do you think that God told him that, or do you think that he just saw the providence of God working in his life?
Joseph?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think God had to tell him that. I think he realized that. I mean, when he was in the position that his brothers didn't recognize him, and he had the power of Pharaoh to get revenge, and he toyed with them. Not be coy about that. He toyed with his brothers, for sure. But when it came to fruition, how did Joseph react to his family coming to Egypt? He was in tears.
Yeah.
He was so happy that he could save them. No.
It doesn't say so, but Joseph, for all of those years, however long it was, that he was in Egypt, he had a relationship with God. He was supremely faithful to save his family when he had the chance to do so. And if he hadn't acted the way he did with his brothers, they wouldn't have brought Benjamin and Jacob to Egypt.
Yep, it was providential, right? God caused it to work for good. And that's the wisdom of God. We see these stories, how they wind and twist down these roads, but we see that God causes them to work for good. And we come to the ultimate winding road of Christ. How he lived his life, up to the age of 30, very little is known, but then through his ministry, just absolutely perfect. Exposed to everything that we're exposed to, but teaches us how to live our lives sinlessly. It's not possible for us. Otherwise, we make God a liar, because all men sin and fall short of the glory of God. But it's something to strive for. The next topic here is how to find wisdom. What is the beginning of wisdom? Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7. That reads, if you really want to gain knowledge, you must begin by having respect for the Lord. But foolish people hate wisdom and training. So where does wisdom begin? And this lesson started with that. If we trust that God is wise, then we trust in God. And we trust him with our whole life, with everything. With everything that we are and everything we have. How is that thought amplified and explained in Proverbs chapter 3 and verses 5 and 6? So when you look at Proverbs chapter 3 and verses 5 and 6, it reads, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not depend on your own understanding. In all your ways, remember him, then he will make your paths smooth and straight. What does us trusting the Lord lead to? Can we say a better life? I'm not going to say an easier life, but how about a better life?
Better life. Here.
A better life? Yeah. Lenny?
Peaceful life.
A peaceful life. And I would almost always love to agree with you. But if you're living in the Philippines in a Muslim-dominated country trying to be a Christian, and you're trusting in the Lord, that doesn't always lead to the peace that you think of, does it?
Going to have the fuse of death because you're
going to
cut your head off.
Well, and I'm not saying that, but I'm saying you're going to face challenges. You're going to face controversy. Yeah. But if you trust in the Lord, it is going to lead to peace. It will.
It's going to lead to heaven anyway.
Right.
That's where the ultimate goal is anyways. your life. They fed the Christians to lions and they were torn to shreds. That was not pleasant. That was not peaceful. That was horrible. But guess where they ended up? In the arms of Jesus. So well, there's the ultimate goal. And we know that we're going to be okay even after we die, or especially after we die.
And those people were at peace because they had an opportunity to renounce Christ and not go to the gladiators or the lions or whatever. And there was peace in their decision that whatever happened, happened. So it's...
Yeah, and that's... We just need to remember that when you think about what that peace is. Peace in your mind, peace in your heart. That doesn't mean your life is going to be peaceful.
No.
But you are peaceful. The last question, I'm going to skip down to it, is what does the wisdom produce? And James chapter 3, verse 17 and 18 tells us that. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is pure. That's the most important thing about it. And that's not all. It also loves peace. It thinks about others. It obeys mercy. I'm sorry, it obeys, it's full of mercy and good fruit, it is fair. It doesn't pretend to be what it is not. Those who make peace should plant peace like a seed. If they do, it will produce a crop of right living. Wisdom, as Lenny said, leads to a peaceful life. That may not be what you think of as a peaceful life, but in your heart and in your mind, it will lead to peace. Because the peace of Jesus, as we're told, surpasses all understanding. And if we're living a life focused on Jesus, then it'll be peaceful. You're going to run into controversy, I guarantee you. If you're living a life for Jesus, what did Jesus tell you you're going to run into? What did he tell his apostles?
Same thing that I got, you're going to get.
And if you are professing Jesus, I guarantee you're going to run into problems. But that's not the peace we're talking about. We're talking about a peaceful life. Your spirit will be at peace because you know you are with God. You know you're living your life for God. And God is going to bless you. And like Abraham, you may not see the blessing right away. But you have to remember that a life with God is a life of peace and blessing. That's lesson 7. I skipped the last couple of verses. It was how to find wisdom and things that God does not reveal.